The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Simon Birkett is on a mission.
It's an extraordinary feeling. Whenever I asked people to sign up to the campaign or help, everyone did.
He wants to rid his city of air pollution.
I wrote a letter to the European Commission, and next thing I was getting calls from Brussels.
And there's quite a few pollutants out there.
So we get diesel exhaust, for example, tyre and brake wear, we get construction dust, coal particles, benzene.
His campaign group is called Clean Air in London. He says there's a hidden epidemic.
Well, it is. I would argue that we are with invisible air pollution where we were 30 years ago with smoking. And I know actually that quite a lot of scientists and also media commentators, particularly those who have been following this story for many years, have actually moved their families outside London and now commute in.
He's one of many around the world trying to do something about the air we breathe. With all the fantastic advances we hear about carbon capture, renewable energy, electric cars, why are we still pumping so much pollution into our atmosphere? Today on the Global Development Podcast, we'll take you to the Philippines, to one of the top three polluted cities in the world. Then to Mexico, to hear how their government is tackling the crisis. And we'll hear from The Guardian's health editor, Sarah Bosley. She'll tell us how pollution is affecting all of our lives. This is the Guardian Global Development Podcast. I'm Hugh Muir. That's all to come. First then, to Manila, where The Guardian's environment editor John Vidal sent us this report.
This is Metro Manila, a 12 million strong megalopolis in the Philippines. It's no different from any number of other major cities in Asia. The smell is awful, and the noise makes it almost impossible to talk. In the end, I've had to record this back in a studio so that you can hear me properly. That's how bad it can be. The hospitals here are full of people with respiratory and heart diseases. The latest figures suggest 2 million people in Asia will die prematurely of air pollution this year. The WHO, that's the World Health Organization, now think that 1 in 8 people in the world dies from air pollution. Jeepneys are the most popular form of transport for Manila's poor, but these brightly coloured buses also leave vast plumes of diesel smoke in their wake. David Posadas has lived in the city for years and is a consultant on urban and green issues.
In the Philippines, normally, right now the law says that all vehicles have to be Euro 2 compliant, new vehicles. But the old vehicles, they have a hard time meeting even Euro 1 standards because a lot of the public vehicles are using these rebuilt engines. And so you see a lot of vehicles when they're accelerating, like these jeepneys and these tricycles, you see visible plumes of black smoke or white smoke.
Is that also because the fuel they use has been adulterated, has been smuggled in? What's going on with the fuel?
Because we are an archipelago of 7,100 islands, it's very easy to smuggle in fuel, and there have been reports of that. Aside from that, there's a lot of contaminants in the fuel, unless you get it from a reputable gas station. And I guess it's not just in the Philippines, but it's a common pattern in Asia.
But you're a refugee. You now live in a suburb 20 kilometers outside the main city. What happened to your health when you moved outside? Did it improve?
Actually, it's not as bad. It improved, but I was getting a lot of respiratory allergies in the city because you could literally see the pollution coming from the vehicles. You would feel it on your skin and your face after a long day of work taking the public transport. A lot of that is really because a lot of these public transport drivers have a hand-to-mouth existence, meaning they probably earn maybe 15 British pounds in a day after a hard day of work. They don't religiously maintain their engines, so you see a lot of engines here that are actually already starting to burn oil.
You're young, and many of the people in the Philippines are very young. We get the impression that it's building up a sort of a public health crisis, which will show itself in 20, 30 years' time as these respiratory diseases become worse and worse. Is that understood in the Philippines, that the air pollution really is a serious problem now?
Originally, I thought only the middle class and the upper middle class understood these things because they were paying for inhalers, you know, the typical bronchodilators and expectorants. But I've also tried to talk to some of these, for example, these jeepney drivers, and I was surprised to learn that they are aware of the risks, and it's like they're caught in a situation where they want to change, but they don't know how.
And because it costs a lot of money to change.
It costs money because if you're running a dilapidated surplus engine, because these public transport conveyances, they don't really get to taste a new engine per se. What they mean by new engine in their case is really a surplus rebuilt engine. So the life of the engine has a limited expectancy. And what they do is, to save money, they try to prolong it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the problem occurs.
But you could also say that the life of the human who's driving some of these cars is pretty limited as well.
Yes. I think they're aware of that. But if you're living a hand-to-mouth existence, I think some of them have this fatalistic view on life, meaning if you talk to them about climate change and other, you know, issues about the world, what they'll tell you is, I have to feed my family. And that's what's paramount to them.
And it's not going to get any better. Within 20 years, the Philippines is expected to be using an extra 10 or 15 million cars. That's per year. And there's no sense that the industry, the fuel companies, or the city is able to do anything about it. And that's not even counting the air pollution that comes from factories or homes. The problem is, it's shortening the lives of everyone. Pollution here follows the poor. It's a world problem, but they're breathing most of it.
Earlier this year in March, some unseasonably warm weather affected countries in Northern Europe. Not a bad thing in itself, but when combined with sand blown in from the Sahara Desert and the fumes from cars and power stations, well, it caused panic in the newsrooms. So what really happened? Sarah Bosley, the health editor here at The Guardian, explains.
There really was a bit of a panic about the air pollution levels in the UK and in parts of Europe as well. I think that's maybe partly because we're increasingly aware that air pollution is very problematic. So the Saharan sand is a very minor issue, actually, by comparison with what we're getting from diesel cars and, more to the point, diesel lorries and taxis and the like. At the end of March, we had the release of a really important report from the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation, who are based at the University of Washington in Seattle. They have been responsible for a whole series of papers, really good papers, looking at what they call the global burden of disease. So they've been calculating what diseases the world suffers from, how many lives are lost, and how many years people live with disabilities because of those diseases. Now they've looked at transport as well, which is a bit of a departure from the usual infectious diseases, chronic diseases, things like, including cancers and such like. What was really interesting in this was that they put together both the air pollution factors and also road injuries. So when you do that, you actually come up with some quite stunning and worrying figures about the damage that our road transport's doing to us.
Hello, everyone. Thank you all for coming today and for your interest in this research.
Katie Leach-Kemen from the Institute of Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington in Seattle, who produced the paper, had some interesting things to say about the way they collected the data, which is not always easy because countries put it together in different ways.
You can also use the tools to look at risk factor rankings across countries. So this shows in Nigeria and China how what the risk factors are for premature death and disability. You can see in China, air pollution, ambient air pollution from all sources, not just vehicles, actually ranks fourth, and in Nigeria it ranks eighth.
They say, in fact, that deaths from road transport are higher. They have a greater burden on the population of the planet than deaths from the things that we all think of as being the big killers, HIV, tuberculosis, and malaria, and that injuries and pollution from vehicles jointly contribute to 6 of the top 10 causes of deaths every year.
As more people are living next to busy roads, the population exposure to traffic-related air pollution is increasing.
And also we had Aaron Cohen, who's principal scientist of the Health Effects Institute in Boston, which is a non-profit, and their interest is air pollution. And he was talking about the ultrafine particles that emanate from diesel school buses.
The geographer Michael Jarrett at University of California at Berkeley, in a recent HGI report, estimated the proportion of the population living near busy roads in several major world cities. This slide shows residential proximity to the burgeoning road network in Beijing, where he estimates that 76% of residents currently live within 500 meters of major highways and 50 meters of busy streets, where levels of traffic-related air pollution emissions are the highest.
It's increasingly worrying that there are such high levels of pollution in developing countries. Very likely developing countries haven't taken this on board yet, because most people think of transport as being a really fundamental, important thing for developing countries, because you have to get your goods from A to B in order to be able to sell them. You know, people have to be able to get to the jobs. Obviously, having good transport, having a car, all helps development. But unfortunately, the downside for health is very much something that people think of as an afterthought.
Sarah Bosley in London. And I don't know about you, but now I'm trying to work out how far I live from a major road. Of course, air respects no borders. Different countries deal with the problems of pollution in different ways. So what are governments doing to make our cities more livable? We sent global development reporter Sam Jones to Mexico City to find out.
I'm standing on a roof garden in Mexico City with Anya Peñalosa, who works for the Environmental Secretariat of Mexico City. We're surrounded by grey, lots of traffic noises and some aeroplanes, but there's a sudden stretch of green here. Anna, can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, well, we're at the top of one of the buildings that are the offices of the Environment Department, Secretary of Mexico City, and we have green roof here. It's open to all the people that works here. In this building, we have the air quality direction. So they are doing all the analysis about the air quality and monitoring of the whole city. We're actually in downtown, and it's like a lot of cars passing around all the time.
I think we can hear those.
Yeah. So this space, it's like being away from that.
What's the public reaction been? I mean, you say it serves a very useful purpose. It helps, you know, purify the air because it drags down some of the nasty gases, which there are, because there's a lot of motor vehicles in Mexico City, as we can hear loud and clear. And it's good for children. And if you work in this bit of the environment department, you can come and have exercise classes on the roof. But what's the public reaction been? What have the people who live in Mexico City, what have they told you about what the project means to them, having these green roofs?
Well, I think that in general, people is very keen. There's a lot of people growing plants and even vegetables in their available spaces at home, like some balconies or even in their rooftop. And the Environmental Education Department has a lot of these kind of projects and workshops teaching people to grow their own food. Even though there are some big parks like Chapultepec, we are trying to put and bring closer to people these green spaces. Like, for example, in hospitals, it's really important because it helps to heal people as well. And in public schools, to teach children to, like, grow plants and vegetables and have green spaces where it's available, where it's possible.
And I mean, the government's, this is one of the measures that they've put in place to try and improve the air quality. And there's a bicycle scheme similar to the Boris bikes in London or the bicycle scheme in Paris. What other steps has the government taken to try and reduce the problems of very polluted air in the city?
Well, have been implemented since the 90s, right? But of course, we believe that transportation modes, it's directly related to air quality in the city. And of course, we're working really hard on that. For example, the public bike scheme started 4 years ago, and it's been a tremendous success. And of course, people is realizing that the alternatives, like transportation alternatives, that are actually more convenient, 80% of the pollution of the city comes from vehicles. It's important that citizens realize that every action they take, it's important and it counts for like having a better air quality and life quality of life in general.
You're from Mexico City. What can you describe what the pollution was like 10 years ago or 20 years ago?
Yeah, it has changed. It has improved, but it's, you know, it's always more and more people living here and the city is growing, and you have to like monitor and control it like continuously.
And as a native of Mexico City, how would you rate the air quality today, this afternoon? If you look around and you big deep breath, how would you describe the air this afternoon?
I mean, it could be better. But I mean, I'm from here, as you said, you know, it's fair enough, it's all right.
Yeah, there's noticeable smog, I think, and some of the buildings, as we get towards the sides of the valley, fade away into greens and into blues and greys, but it doesn't feel quite as bad as it was when I was last here 11 years ago. I mean, you think there's definitely been an improvement?
Yeah, when I was a child, yeah, it's definitely a really noticeable difference. All I can say is that we have to like keep working on this. And of course, like changing habits, choosing bicycle instead of your car.
So progress.
Yes, definitely. And I really think that Mexico should be a global example of policies to improve air quality in one of the largest cities of the world.
Sam Jones speaking to Anya Peñalosa. Well, I'm pleased to say we've gathered all of the correspondents you've just heard in our studio. That's John Vidal, Sam Jones and Sarah Bosley. Welcome to all of you. Sam, let me start with you. Tell me a bit about what it's like, because you left London, you went to Mexico City. Was it obvious that the air was different? Was it obvious that the atmosphere was different to you?
It's a very noticeable difference. There's a kind of constant haze, a kind of pall that hangs in the sky. If you try and climb up a few flights of stairs, you'll find your lungs are working a little bit harder than they would in London.
Of course, we heard about the green roofs and cycle schemes. Do those sort of things really make a difference?
I think they have made a difference. Mexico City I saw last week was very different to the Mexico City I saw 11 years ago. Going back 11 years, there was much more pollution. It was denser. The streets were still full of the kind of iconic green and white Volkswagen Beetle taxis. They've disappeared now. You're seeing liquid gas powered buses, and perhaps the most noticeable difference is seeing people cycling in Mexico City, which I wouldn't have imagined a little over a decade ago. Brave people take to their bikes in Mexico City, about 27,000 journeys a day so far, and that's rising. In terms of the green roofs, it seems to have captured the public's imagination to a certain extent. I mean, putting green roofs on top of buildings is not going to cure problems in a city of 21 million people with a massive, massive pollution problem. But it does seem to be serving an educational purpose, and people are starting to think about the way they travel. But clearly, you're going to need rather more than that to sort out the effects of millions and millions of highly polluting cars.
John Vidal, we've recently seen Paris halving the amount of traffic that it's allowing into its cities. Centre to reduce smog, and Beijing tried that too. Does that work?
No.
Why not?
There's still far too much of it. I mean, it's the scale of what's going on at the moment is so enormous, and I'm a bit of a pessimist. And just because if you can see pollution, that's only the very top bit. What really gets people is that you can't see. They're so small, and we're talking about the 2.5 microns. This is the stuff which goes right down in your lung. You can't see that. We think that if we can smell pollution that's bad. It's not. The worst stuff is the stuff you can't smell, you can't see it. It's invisible. It gets right down in there. That's the really dangerous stuff. That's the stuff the WHO is now realizing is leading to the heart attacks and so many of the respiratory problems. We've just swapped one kind of pollution, which was factories burning coal, for another kind of pollution, which is really largely sort of from gases like NO2 and the particulate pollution. And that's the dangerous stuff. So just getting rid of a few cars is not going to be enough. You have to do it on a very large scale to make any difference at all.
Sarah Bosley, it's not just about the shorter life expectancy, is it? There are implications for children as well. Tell us about those.
Well, it's interesting. Once upon a time, we used to think that, you know, pollution perhaps made asthma a lot worse for people, and particularly for kids. And as time has gone on, we've realised that actually you're talking about an awful lot of diseases and cancers. And the latest thing, I mean, I was quite stunned to see a study in October last year that said that air pollution could actually cause low birth weight in babies. And that is really quite an incredible link. But this, in fact, it's a European study. So even more, you know, I mean, you're not even looking at the developing world. You know, I've been to Kathmandu and seen horrible, horrible pollution in the cities there. It, again, as John's saying, it's often the stuff we're not seeing. You're seeing low birth weight babies, and they think that air pollution may have a cause for that.
East London, I was talking to doctors, respiratory doctors at King's College. They're measuring, by the age of five, they can see that the birth weight of babes has gone down, and you can already see the neurological effects on children that age.
And why East London? What do we know about?
Because there's
East
very,
London?
Very heavy traffic going through those main roads. If you're living within 100 yards of those roads, you are effectively being polluted. I mean, and seriously polluted.
It does stand to reason, actually, because, you know, we know that smoking causes low birth weight, so why shouldn't air pollution?
Sam Jones, do you feel that people that you met in Mexico City actually felt that this was a priority? Obviously, the politicians go to international gatherings and they know that globally people think it's important, but do the people on the ground really felt we must do something about the air?
I don't think it's reached critical mass by any means. I mean, it's a gigantic city and most people have more pressing concerns, many people living hand-to-mouth existence, and I think it's fair to say that improving air quality is not even on their list of priorities at the moment. Politicians are doing what they can, and you know the Environmental Secretariat of Mexico City is very keen to stress that it's actually advising Tehran on its air quality at the moment. I was told while I was there that some of the C40 cities have shown an interest in some of the kind of smartphone applications that Mexico City government is using. But in terms of on the ground take up and involvement in any kind of push to improve air quality, no evidence of that.
Hugh, can I just say, I think there's a major problem is that we thought this was one of the environmental problems which had gone away. We thought 20 years ago, got rid of the coal mines, whatever, it had gone. It hasn't. And so there's a big perception gap with the politicians. They haven't one in 12 people dying of diseases linked, you know, directly to air pollution. It's extraordinary.
But explain that though, because it did seem logical that once you got rid of all the dirty fuel, that this problem would be better.
It hasn't gone away, but it hasn't got up with it. I mean, we, the media, I think, have been very bad at it. We haven't realized. What has also happened is that the medics are beginning to appreciate much, much more the link. So there's a lot of advances which have been done in the field of medicine, which are making people understand this is much more serious than we thought.
Yeah, but I would say actually that, you know, pollution is a complicating factor in other diseases. So actually you can't blame just the pollution for the death. It's just not like that. You know, people will have a genetic propensity and there will be other things in their lives that are causing the problem. So that's one of the reasons why it's been overlooked.
So does that mean then that we are underestimating the amount of it, because some people will die and as you say, their deaths won't be attributed to pollution, there'll be other things, but in fact pollution will have been the crucial factor?
No, I think we are starting to appreciate it, and that's what these studies are about. And the WHO has attributed far more lung cancer and bladder cancer now to air pollution, for instance. And they can do some very clever stuff with studies where they factor out everything else. So we are seeing it, as John says, for the first time. But I think in the past that a perception that it had gone away was perhaps because it was mixed up with other stuff too.
Sam, in Mexico City, what did you feel was driving their initiatives there? Was it an altruism that we should think more about people's health, or was it a political imperative? What do you think was behind it?
I think some of it is altruism, and some of it is a kind of firefighting. When you've got a city that big and it's ever growing, if you've ever flown into Mexico City, you look past the wing and it stretches on and on and on. There's more people arriving every day. It's a genuine megacity, something has to be done because it won't be habitable, you know, if things get much worse. You know, 20 years ago they had the bright idea of moving the refineries out of the city, which has made a massive difference, clearly. The other factor in all this is, you know, Mexico is an emerging country, an emerging economy, recently hosted a huge high-level meeting on global development and how to work better. And it's projecting itself as a forward-looking country, as the kind of country that will take seriously, you know, sort of developed country concerns such as environment, such as air quality. So it's two-pronged. Yes, they're trying to make things better for the people who live there, because they have to, because it's giant and it's very polluted. And also they're trying to show that they are capable of being this world player.
But John, it's difficult, isn't it? Because you have this phenomenon of countries emerging and becoming more industrially developed, but a lot of things come with that. And it's difficult for the developed world to say to those countries that are emerging, don't do this, because they say, well, hang on, that's what you did to become as powerful and as rich as you are.
Yeah, but there are lessons to be learned from everyone's progress, if you like. I think what's happening in China is very, very interesting. There you have pollution on a very, very great scale now, and that's mainly it's industrial pollution mixed with the traffic, and there I think the authorities are realizing that unless they do get it under control, then they stand the real risk of civil unrest, of civil problems, all kinds of other things, you know, attached to it. So if you live in a polluted city, and I've been to these people get really hacked off, and they really don't like it, and that's a trigger for political dissent. And I think that will be one of the reasons why China gets its act together much quicker than some other countries.
So to what extent do you think the international bodies, the international health bodies, are really gripping this? To what extent do you think that they may not have solved it, but they're on top of the scale of the problem?
I don't think, actually, they're focusing on it as perhaps a lot of people would like them to. And that's simply because there's so much else happening all the time. You know, we're now into a situation where we have to worry about the spread of chronic diseases. So we've got heart disease and cancers caused by other things, such as lack of exercise and eating the wrong foods. That's the up-and-coming thing now, what they call the non-communicable diseases. So what happens is that there are sort of fashions in health, in the things that people turn their attentions to, and this isn't as high a priority as a lot of people would like.
What are ordinary people doing? I suppose I'd just like to get some sense of what the ordinary listener can do, because all of this is being solved at a very macro level, of a governmental level, but ordinary people have to go out and walk in polluted air. What sort of things were they doing in Mexico, Sam, quickly?
The people who are concerned about this are trying to use carpooling to cut down on the amount of pollution, or rationalise a little bit more. Mexico City is rather too big to walk round. Those that care and that can get on the bike scheme and pedal their way around. That's rising, but if you're poor and you've got a long distance to travel in Mexico City, you're not left with very many options. It's basically the bus.
John, I thought technology was supposed to save us from all of this. Why isn't it, or will it?
Face masks. That's what we need.
That's very old technology.
No,
isn't
I mean
it?
No, it is in a funny way that you just got to stop breathing in the worst bits. And unfortunately, the most of the masks are really not much use at all, frankly.
It actually doesn't stop the particles.
But every time you see someone with a mask, you think, "Ooh, this air is polluted." So you do actually take more care. So in a way, it is quite good. No, the only way anyone has ever found to reduce air pollution is to either cut down, get the factories burning much less fuel, and get the cars to burn, electric or something completely different, or get rid of the cars. That's the only way you're going to do it. Otherwise, it will build up and build up.
And Sarah, what's the health advice? Is any kind of credible, sensible health advice being given to people who live in areas that have this serious problem?
Well, the distressing thing is how little you can do about it. And pregnant women are a case in point. What do you do? You can give up smoking, you can give up alcohol. You can't stop yourself in Bradford breathing in the diesel fumes from the buses and the lorries. And it's not just cars, of course. But you can try to help the community as a whole by walking, by cycling, by those sort of things. But you can't actually protect yourself. You have to make a fuss about it.
Well, Hughie, there was one thing which I noticed last week, which was rather beautiful. The most polluted place in the whole of Britain happens to be Kensington, Chelsea, the richest borough in the whole of London. And this was quite extraordinary. Why? Because of the cars. They all drive very large diesels around there, and also because they got some big railway engines which burn a lot of diesel. But it is funny that the pollution does actually follow the rich as well.
Well, it does show, doesn't it, how things change, because not so long ago diesel was supposed to be the thing that was going to save us from all of this,
and
that thinking's all been turned on its head. But that's it for this edition of the Guardian Global Development Podcast. My thanks to John Vidal, Sam Jones and Sarah Bosley. for all our contributors, and of course to you for listening. If you have any comments about the programme or want to add your voice to the discussion, head to theguardian.com/globaldevelopment, and please subscribe to hear future podcasts via iTunes or another podcatching service. My name's Hugh Muir, the producer was Matt Hill. Until next time, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code GUARDIAN.